listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's this month's editor's letter from Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief, The Road to Hollywood. In the photos, Margaret Qualley and Radhika Jones backstage at the Hollywood shoot. I write this at the dawn of the 20s, less roaring than blustering so far. The year 2020 always sounded so futuristic, and yet here we are, having closed out the Skywalker saga, and with it, my childhood, and proved indisputably that Cats does not have nine lives at the box office. War drums beat, bushfires burn, and the great escapism of cinema offers respite and provocation alike. So here is our annual Hollywood issue, celebrating a terrific year at the movies and looking ahead to the next season in film. Every year, Vanity Fair travels the festival circuit from Sundance to Cannes, Telluride to Toronto, seeing movies and charting and creating buzz. And this time, as the slate of films unfolded, we were struck by the number of legends bestriding the screen like the acting colossuses that they are. Many appeared on our covers over the past 12 months. Laura Dern, Adam Driver, Lupita Nyong'o, Joaquin Phoenix, and three more came together for this cover, shot by Vanity Fair contributing photographer Ethan James Green. I won't wax lyrical about their performances. Mark Harris does that beautifully. But I will say that paramount on our minds when making that image was the versatility, persistence, and sheer scope of talent represented by Jennifer Lopez, Eddie Murphy, and Renee Zellweger. They are road warriors, not just of this season, but of our era, and we'd follow them down any highway. Our trio kicks off a photographic road trip that I hope you'll experience both digitally and in the magazine. Online, the images create a surreal Route 66, scrolling through American film archetypes. In print, they unfold into lush panoramas of our cinematic dreamscape. We feature newcomers and veterans alike, from Beanie Feldstein and Park Sodom to Willem Dafoe and Antonio Banderas. Behind the scenes in Hollywood, change is afoot, and we've got that covered too, from Maureen O'Connor's account of the precipitous fall of publicist Peggy Siegel, starting from the fateful moment last summer on a yacht, Natch, when she learned that her name would be linked with Jeffrey Epstein's in the damning reports of his crimes, to Joy Press's revealing profile of Kenya Barris as he prepares for his first Netflix show after leaving broadcast TV. Executive Hollywood editor Jeff Giles and VF.com editor Matt Lynch presided over the issue, which looks fondly back. Remember the fake club, the 80s Hollywood hotspot, and perceptively forward. What's next for Ari Emanuel and his power agency? The movies have never felt more everywhere. They come not only to our multiplexes and art houses, but to our home screens and our phones. And in February, Vanity Fair brings our legacy of Hollywood photography to the exhibition space in a show titled Vanity Fair, Hollywood Calling, mounted in partnership with the Annenberg Space for Photography in Los Angeles. Iconic images from the magazine's archives created by the likes of Annie Leibovitz, Collier Shore, and David LaChapelle, depicting stars from Whoopi Goldberg and Tom Hanks to Michael B. Jordan and Ali Wong, pay homage to our legacy of creating and reflecting contemporary film iconography, capturing star power in glorious technicolor and glamorous black and white. The show opens February 8th, and we'll see you there. Empire Building by Joe Pompeo. The Obamoguls, propelled by still potent political hope, Barack and Michelle have gone multi-platform. Opening illustration by Parker Hubbard. The Obama campaign's emotional uplift has been translated to Spotify podcast, Penguin Books, and Netflix shows. To a player like Donald Trump, deals that sweet had to be fishy. Look at the Obama book deal, he implored lawmakers this past September, or the ridiculous Netflix deal. It may be particularly galling to Trump that, where it took him the better part of 2 decades to become a multi-platform media powerhouse, Barack and Michelle Obama have essentially done it in 2 years. In addition to their political and philanthropic activity, they're making movies and shows for Netflix, podcasts for Spotify, bestsellers for Penguin Random House, mega events for Live Nation and making themselves super rich along the way. Their explosion of personal wealth may be head-turning, but the Obamas have managed to do it without sacrificing too much of their ethical cachet. Their budding media portfolio has a certain recombinant brilliance, fusing familiar elements to create a new cultural prestige, something with the potential to further magnify the Obamas' already outsized influence. Those quasi-political feelings Barack Obama inspired on the stump are still what they're selling. As he put it a touch more earnestly in a brief YouTube video last summer, one way of looking at what we've both been doing for the last 20 years, maybe most of our careers, was to tell stories. You want to be in relationships with people and connect with them and work together with them. If getting rich is a byproduct, so be it. The Obamas are putting a new spin on an old playbook. Former first couples have been parlaying their White House credentials into lucrative next acts for decades, primarily through board seats, bestsellers, and the public speaking circuit. But a confluence of circumstances makes the Obamas' post-presidential livelihood a sui generis proposition. Barack Obama's proven gifts as a best-selling author, Michelle Obama's saintly popularity, which rivals or exceeds her husband's, the rise of streaming entertainment and social media as mass distribution engines, the intense nostalgia felt by more than half the country for the era in which the Obamas reigned. Even by the remunerative standards of presidential book writing, the $65 million that Penguin Random House reportedly paid Barack and Michelle Obama was unprecedented, as was the rock star-level arena tour that Michelle Obama embarked on to promote her book, Becoming. Barack Obama's presidential memoir has been coming along more slowly. It's not lost on the Obama Brain Trust that publishing it in the middle of the 2020 campaigns could be helpful to the Democratic nominee, but ultimately, the timing is driven by the writing process, and it will come out when it's ready, an Obama confidant told me. As for their other media endeavors, the Obamas' multi-year content deal with Netflix is rumored to rival their publishing payday. Their agreement to make podcasts for Spotify isn't quite as lofty, but it is still said to be in the $10 million to $20 million range, according to sources in the audio scene. Additional media projects will presumably follow, all under the banner of Higher Ground Productions, which the Obamas incorporated last year. The whole thing is an enormous bet on a sort of premium civic storytelling, an intersection of literary sensibilities and leftish, ameliorative politics. The Obamas, who declined to be interviewed, hired two veteran producers, Tanya Davis and Priya Swaminathan, to run the film and television part of the company, which is headquartered in West Hollywood. Dan Fearman, formerly of MTV News, recently came on board as head of audio. Sam Fisher, a veteran Hollywood lawyer and Obama fundraiser, is Higher Ground Steelmaker. The Obamas chose the name in homage to Stevie Wonder. Higher Ground is generally steering clear of overtly political content, gravitating instead toward a more earnest oeuvre that preaches the gospel of empowerment. A Frederick Douglass biopic, a documentary about the origins of the disability rights movement, a global food series for preschoolers. The company's inaugural production, American Factory, about a shuttered GM plant, garnered a fair amount of Oscar buzz. Projects like these are like a plate of broccoli, but the Obamas' power is such that they can theoretically convince huge numbers of people to devour that broccoli. Sam Dolnick, a New York Times editor who develops film, television, and audio projects, said the goal for adapting the paper's overlooked obituary series into a Netflix show with higher ground was to reach as many people as possible. "We made a bet that the Obama's imprimatur would help significantly," he told me. At the same time, Higher Ground has made a point of letting creators know that frivolity isn't verboten. Someone who's taken a meeting with them told me, "They've said Barack and Michelle watch everything. They love things you'd never think they love, and we're open to that. We could even do a horror movie or a big comedy. But the reality is, when you actually look at a horror movie, people have to die brutal, disgusting deaths. Do you really want your name on that? And jokes, by their nature, kind of have to offend someone. It's a hard line to walk." As in politics, luck played a major role. The Obamas arrived on the media scene just as the streaming wars drove up prices for content of all kinds. Executives from Apple and Amazon were reportedly in pursuit. So was HBO. Richard Plepler put up flares as the Obamas were leaving office, but it was already more or less a given that the first couple were Netflix-bound, considering their long-standing close rapport with Reed Hastings and Ted Sarandos. In particular, Sarandos and his wife, Nicole Avant, had gotten to know the Obamas during their administration, hosting a fundraiser at their Beverly Hills home that brought in more than $700,000 during the 2012 re-election campaign. "The relationship with Ted was a large piece of this," said the Obama confidant. Plepler, who left HBO to start his own production company, told me, "They have great taste, access to the best talent, and global distribution. If you have all of those three, it's not hard to see them succeeding at this. I would bet on them." A more cynical assessment is that the Obamas are in the game of big-time wealth accumulation. To be fair, they are still heavily engaged in political, civic, and philanthropic endeavors, voter registration, the National Democratic Redistricting Committee, the nonprofit Obama Presidential Center on the south side of Chicago. But at the end of the day, all indications are that they want to be Al Gore rich, not Jimmy Carter rich. Even some of their fans may question whether that jibes with the core goodness and idealism that has made them so beloved. As another Hollywood source who took a meeting with Higher Ground put it, "It's got the Democratic halo, but there's this bourgeois element." Those closest to the Obamas reject that notion. "Their paths have always been driven by public service," says Valerie Jarrett, "and these resources give them an opportunity to have even more of an impact. If they're a force for good and are able to do well and make money at the same time, I think that's what we should hope for from all business leaders." While neither of them has said much thus far about Trump and 2020, the energy and passion of our current political moment is sure to make their upcoming adventures in the media space all the more provocative. In the fall, Barack Obama took some baby steps back toward the political arena, appearing at a handful of fundraisers to galvanize the faithful, possibly a welcome distraction from writer's block. At one such intimate donor confab in late October, he swung by the NoHo pad of Alexander Soros for an NDRC dinner with Eric Holder and Terry McAuliffe, issuing a salvo about voting rights. "I vowed to myself we wouldn't be caught sleeping next time." Obama won't be sleeping. After the Democratic National Convention this summer, the general election will be in full swing, and Obama will be out there campaigning for the chosen candidate. Higher Ground will have more projects in the market, and maybe, just maybe, Barack Obama's memoir will be on shelves. By then, the Obama media footprint could look almost Trumpian. ¶¶ Money Matters by William D. Cohen, Trading Places, The Frothy Marriage Between Hollywood and Wall Street, May Be Too Hot Not to Cool Down. Opening illustration by Ryan Garcia, which depicts a man in a suit on a stand-up paddleboard which is shaped like a Hollywood star. The water he's paddling in is blood red, and he is surrounded by shark fins and dollar bills. Officially, Will Smith was on hand to promote his new film, Gemini Man, but it's increasingly hard to tell which is his day job. Smith, the actor and rapper famous for such movies as Hitch, I Am Legend, and Men in Black, was on stage at the TechCrunch Disrupt Conference on October 2nd in San Francisco, conducting an impromptu bake-off between four entrepreneurs to see who would get a cash infusion from Smith's venture capital fund, Dreamers VC. Of course, since movie stars trying their hand at venture capital is now one of Hollywood's hottest things, Smith wasn't the only actor disrupting the Disrupt Conference. Joseph Gordon-Levitt was also there talking about Hit Record, an online startup dedicated to creative collaboration. Maisie Williams, Arya from Game of Thrones, was discussing Daisy, an app for which she had just raised $2.5 million that, like Hit Record, is dedicated to creative collaboration. Ashton Kutcher, the grand old man of actor investing, was also on hand. Kutcher was one of the judges of Startup Battlefield, a kind of American Idol for tech startups. Smith started Dreamers VC, which has around $100 million to invest, in July 2018 with Keisuke Honda, a Japanese soccer star, using money from Japanese investors looking to get in on early-stage U.S. startups. "We just hit it off immediately," Smith said at the TechCrunch conference about his partnership with Honda. "We felt like there was a beautiful intersection between being able to create businesses, but also to stay focused on solving problems of the world." They had each been investing on their own, but decided to join forces. "Our values were in alignment," Smith said. Smith and Honda lead a team of five professionals, including Melissa Danis, the chief of staff, who looks like a Hollywood actor, and D.A. Wallach, a Harvard-educated singer-investor who looks like a young Bob Dylan, and who also has an investing partnership with Ron Burkle, the Los Angeles supermarket buyout billionaire. On its website, Dreamers list 38 investments, including those in boba guys. They have retail stores that make and sell boba milk tea, and Elon Musk, the Boring Company, which is hoping to build urban tunnels to alleviate traffic, and in Just Water, a politically correct packaged water company. At TechCrunch, Smith jokingly ratcheted up the pressure on the four entrepreneurs as they were sharing their 45-second elevator pitches. "It's only an opportunity of a lifetime," he told them, "and everything rides on this, so just relax into that." First up was Airby, a startup that hopes to be the Uber or Airbnb of bicycles. Then there was Bitter, an app that connects Latino construction workers with job opportunities. Smith seemed particularly struck by the appearance of Cody, the Bitter presenter. "You should sell your handsomeness along with your product," Smith said. But it was Kofi Frimpong, the co-founder of Socionado, which helps small companies beef up their online social media and marketing presence, who really blew Smith away. "I'm in," Smith announced. "I'm in." He hopped right up and stood next to the more physically imposing Frimpong. "Let's rock a selfie," Smith said, adding that Frimpong could post the picture to his social media accounts and that Dreamers would invest $10,000 in Socionado. In an interview a month later, Frimpong was still buzzing about the experience. He says it all happened serendipitously. "Trust me," he says, "if I knew, I was presenting on stage in front of Will Smith." I would have gotten a haircut. By early December, a plan was in place for an investment in excess of the promised $10,000. But there are tangible benefits besides money to Smith's interest in the company. The picture of them together, posted to LinkedIn by Frimpong, is approaching about 1 million views, he says, plus supercharged traction on Instagram and Twitter. The symbiosis between show business and Wall Street is at a frothy peak, as actors like Smith, Gordon-Levitt, and Williams, among others, ramp up their involvement. It's a favored hobby for entertainers in their downtime, and for Wall Street types anxious to hang out with the glitterati. Ben Horowitz, the co-founder of Andreessen Horowitz, the Silicon Valley venture capital firm, is a big fan of Nas, the rapper, and they have been investing together for years, including in the company's Rap Genius and Bevel. He just loves him, one longtime Hollywood Observer says of Horowitz's relationship with Nas. Venture capital can also be highly lucrative at the moment. Ed Norton's private equity investments have seriously amplified his wealth. Thanks in large part to his early investments in Uber, CrowdRise, EDO and Kensho, an analytics and artificial intelligence company that S&P Global bought for $550 million in 2018, Norton has a net worth estimated at around $80 million. In many different show business fields, the talent now believes it's also the brains, and in many cases, the talent is right. The latest mind-blowing example of Hollywood colliding with Wall Street is Kylie Jenner, the youngest Kardashian sister, who is all of 22. Back when she was merely 18, Jenner started Kylie Cosmetics to market and sell makeup to her millions of Instagram followers. It was no fluke. In its first 18 months, the company generated $420 million in revenue. In November, Jenner sold 51% of Kylie Cosmetics to Coty, the publicly traded cosmetics company, for $600 million, a price that valued the entire company at nearly $1.2 billion. In March 2019, Forbes named her the world's youngest self-made billionaire. The whole Kardashian thing, they are a machine, says Chris Silberman, the managing partner at ICM Partners, the Hollywood talent and literary agency. That's just business. They've run companies. They know how to build brands, run brands, leverage their social media platform. That's the top of the pyramid in terms of how to do this. The premier actor-investor has long been Kutcher, who makes occasional appearances on CNBC's Shark Tank, alongside professional investors such as Barbara Corcoran, Mark Cuban, Kevin O'Leary, and Lori Grenier. Although Kutcher declined to be interviewed, Cuban, his fellow Shark Tank star, emailed me about Kutcher, the investor. One of the best. He is a learner. He reads, pays attention to what is happening around him, and looks for investments that can deliver and or disrupt. I'm really happy to have worked with him and would do more. Kutcher's been investing in venture capital deals for a decade, and he's good at it. He's the co-founder, along with Guy Osiri, the manager of Madonna and U2, of A-grade investments and a second fund, Sound Ventures. Burkle was the third founding investor in A-grade. Burkle invested $8 million. Kutcher and Osiri invested $1 million each. The first three letters of A-grade correspond to the first three letters of the three founders' first names. 6 years later, in 2016, Kutcher was on the cover of Forbes, being celebrated for his canny investments in Uber, Airbnb, Spotify, Skype, Pinterest, and Warby Parker, among others, and because he and Osiri had managed to turn the initial $30 million in A-grade into $250 million, or a return of more than eight times the initial investment. While Kuchar has been playing the game for years, the field is definitely more crowded these days. Could it be the modern-day equivalent of the old Wall Street saw about how in 1929, Joseph Kennedy Sr., the father of the future President of the United States, as well as the future first chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, realized it was time to sell all his stocks and preserve his multi-generational fortune when the guy shining his shoes offered him stock tips? While Silberman advises his Hollywood clients to steer clear of private equity investments because it too often takes them away from what should be their primary focus, their acting careers, he does not think the new wave of actors investing in deals is indicative of a market top. He says it doesn't seem as crazy now as it did during the dot-com bubble. 1999 felt, this is effing crazy, and everybody was going in every deal, he says. But Scott Galloway, the iconoclastic professor of marketing at NYU's Stern School of Business, thinks this so-called sector surfing, where professionals from one industry think they can make a go of it in an unrelated profession, is a sign of a market top. Sector surfing is a sport, he says. It's not an investment strategy. So Jeff Bezos getting to go to the Academy Awards, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just going to cost him billions of dollars. The majority of the people who are successful in private equity are people in private equity, Galloway continues. But whenever you have a sector that outperforms other sectors, it immediately draws people from other industries, and everybody likes hanging out with actors. Actors almost always have a free entry pass to any sector they decide is interesting. But it's usually a forward-looking indicator, that returns are about to plummet. Added one Wall Street lawyer bluntly, I think these guys are going to get their heads handed to them. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Pedro Almodovar, the director of Pain and Glory, talks samba and social justice. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A sudden summer breeze on a hot afternoon. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Federico Garcia Lorca. Which living person do you most admire? Dr. Pedro Cavadas, a pioneer in face transplants and a specialist in the transplant of severed members. This surgeon from Valencia devotes his summer breaks to travel to Africa and tend to children who have been castrated in tribal conflicts. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Sincerity in its most brutal version. It isn't always necessary. On what occasion do you lie? The few times I go to a movie premiere or to a theater opening in the artist dressing rooms. Which living person do you most despise? I don't despise. I prefer to hate. And I hate Trump. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? In Spanish, no doy crédito. I cannot believe my eyes. In English, I usually abuse actually. What is your greatest regret? If I make a mistake, I try to apologize. But regret is an imposition from my Catholic childhood that I refuse. When and where were you happiest? The first time I went into a samba school in Rio de Janeiro, the whole neighborhood was rehearsing in plain clothes the numbers they'd performed during the carnival. Which talent would you most like to have? To be a great novelist. What is your current state of mind? I miss my youth. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? You have to accept family the way it is. What is your most treasured possession? Memories. Materially speaking, 18 of the 21 films I have directed. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? All miseries are unfair and unbearable, but migrants running away from war and slavery, only to find first world doors closed, seems intolerable to me. The other side of this problem is people condemned to unalleviated poverty in the first world, which seems horrible to me too. Where would you like to live? For the time being, in Madrid, where I feel most comfortable and organized. What is your favorite occupation? To rewrite, when I have the story for a script clear and defined. What is your most marked characteristic? I never give up. What is the quality you most like in a man? Originality and lack of prejudices. What is the quality you most like in a woman? The capacity to fight. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Don Quixote. Who are your heroes in real life? The ONG Open Arms, whose members risk their lives and freedom to save migrants from drowning in the Mediterranean Sea. What are your favorite names? Antonio, Carmen, Soledad, Eurydice, and Faith. How would you like to die? Like John Huston, after shooting the dead. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Pedro Almodovar. From Brett Hinemuth comes the opening act column. Lashana Lynch enters the James Bond legacy at a pivotal moment in its history. No Time to Die, the installment out in April, will be the first film in the almost 60-year-old $7 billion franchise to land in a post-#MeToo world. The British actress, who broke out as Maria Rambeau in Captain Marvel, has shaken and stirred Hollywood's modern classic, arriving as Nomi, the new 00 agent, and rumored heir apparent as Daniel Craig takes his last Aston Martin ride. Here, some insights gleaned from a conversation with a woman undercover. She was born in London to Jamaican parents, and an early passion for R&B enticed her to drama school. You can't sing without acting, and you can't act without singing. It's all sounds, accents, and emotion. She favored Brandy, Mariah Carey, SWV, and Boys to Men. I had a lot of fun singing with a hairbrush to those. She studied at the prestigious Arts Ed School and cut her teeth on London stages before American TV titan Shonda Rhimes cast her in the short-lived ABC series Still Star-Crossed in 2017. It was colorblind casting at its finest. It doesn't have to be exact. It just needs to be honest. Her 007 training started early. When I was only months old, my dad would sit me down under his arm on the couch and make me watch Bond. She's hard-pressed to pick a favorite. Daniel Craig brings the grittiness of London, which I absolutely love. But after Daniel, it's impossible to answer, because they all bring something really spicy. I did like Sean Connery. Her gadget of choice would be a time-traveling watch that could make me a fly on the wall, anywhere. She hopes her character, Nomi, brings a new layer of relatability to the world of espionage. When you're dealing with a franchise that has been slick for so many years, I wanted to throw a human spin on it, to deal with anxiety and be someone who's figuring it out, completely on her toes. She credits Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who was recruited to polish the film's script, with bringing an evolved female perspective to the Bond girls of the past. She injected a natural richness into Nomi. Phoebe was able to cater to the women and bring something punchy, unique, and fresh. The buzz surrounding a modernized franchise has led some online trolls to be upset that the next 007 might be played by a black woman. The good can be bad, and also sad, Lynch says. It's healthy to talk about it, because it reminds you, unfortunately, about where the world is right now, but also of the work that we have to do as people who have a platform to speak. Up next, she stars in Why, an FX series directed by Melina Matsoukas, based on the comic book series set in a post-apocalyptic world ruled by women. I would say many people in the world right now have dreams of a female-run world, and we actually get to fulfill that dream. In the fan mail, Brie Larson said, her empathy and humanity as an actor bring magic to every scene. Daniel Craig said, Lashana moves like a cat. And Melina Matsoukas said, we enjoyed jumping around Brooklyn. Lashana's very much a Brooklynite, even though she's from Britain.
Thank you.
years, Paramount's Hollywood Cocktails book pairs their films with drink recipes. The talented Mr. Ribley, the ne plus ultra adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's beloved thriller, replete with creamy fashion and ice-cold kills. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, a buddy comedy with a dash of romance wrapped in a love letter to Chicago and doused in one of film's great unsung soundtracks. And the drink is Ferrari Named Desire. The Americano was the drink for the talented Mr. Ripley. The Espresso Martini is the drink for Beverly Hills Cop. Peak Eddie Murphy improv, sunny L.A., a gallery assistant, peddling artisanal coffee, 35 years and two sequels later, Netflix is now planning round four. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina.